You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You may know Glenn Ford as the rugged star of countless classic movies, from Gilda and The Big Heat to Blackboard Jungle and 310 to Yuma. My next guest knew him as Dad, and Peter Ford has explored the complicated life and career of his father in a new biography from the University of Wisconsin Press called, simply enough, Glenn Ford, A Life. I'm very pleased that Peter Ford could join us today here on the show. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
You wrote that you probably got to know Glenn Ford at around the same time that the rest of the world did. Were you born when, just about when he started becoming a star?
Yes, at that very moment, actually. He was cast in Stolen Life with Bette Davis when I was born, and went on to do Gilda. But I was just a kid at home with a mother and father, and I was not aware, of course, at that age until I was much older, that, you know, who he was or that they were famous or it meant anything. So,
well, at the time, your mother was probably more famous than he was.
Yes, in the late 30s, she was the big star at MGM in those
Eleanor
days.
Eleanor Powell.
Eleanor Powell is my mother, and I'm their only child.
And then she quit the business?
Yes, she did about the time I was born, although I think, quite frankly, that era, the great musical days of the 1930s, had come to an end, and we were preparing for war, and that kind of shifted into a whole – that's when the film noir started, and we became a much more sober society. And so I think those exuberant musicals kind of were on their way out. So it was good timing. And she was about ready to retire. I was born, and she was a blessed angel to me as her son.
And what did people like Fred Astaire do during that time?
Well, they worked.
They worked together.
Yeah.
Also.
Well, actually, Mom and Fred did one film together, Broadway Melody, in 1940, which is, I think, by some, arguably one of the finest musicals ever made. And they were both at the top of their form in that film. And a lot of people, in fact, Fred Astaire even said that Eleanor Powell was the greatest dancer on film, including himself. So that's a pretty good, you know.
Did she do a lot of dancing around the house?
Yeah, she did. Oh, yeah.
Did you feel that she missed the career?
I think she did. When they wanted to buy a home, my dad, it was just starting his career. He had been active since 1939, but he was a B actor in the lesser films at Columbia. And so when they wanted to buy their first home, she put on the tap shoes and went on the road and did a lot of personal appearances and actually made the money to put down on the first house.
Could your father dance at all?
No, and nor can I.
Uh-huh. She could have married James Cagney gotten the best of both worlds.
That is true. Actually, Jimmy Stewart proposed to her, and Robert Taylor, and interesting enough, Al Jolson was one of her suitors, but she held out and married my father.
And how had they met?
Well, it's a very long story, which I know we don't have time to get into. Basically, they were introduced by Pat O'Brien, and briefly, Pat was on a Bond tour for the war, World War II, of course, with my mother and Merle Oberon and many other, Laurel and Hardy, and he befriended my mother, and Pat had just finished a movie with my father called Flight Lieutenant, which was one of the last movies he made before he went into the Marines. And so he hooked them up together and thought the two of them would make a nice couple, and it worked.
And you said, as many children of movie stars say, that you just knew them as Mom and Dad. But it had to be different because all the kids you met knew them as somebody else, and Dad was going off to work and make a movie, and at a certain point you probably saw one of those films. You remember the first film you saw?
Well, the first set I visited wasn't on one of my father's. It was Rita Hayworth, who was doing Lady in Shanghai with Orson. She was Orson Welles, and she was a blonde in that one. So that was my first movie set. But it really wasn't until about 1953, when he was making like the Big Heat that you mentioned, and that I became aware that he was not going off to do, you know, he wasn't a house painter or not that there's anything wrong with that, but he was just, you know, when I saw my parents sending out autographed pictures, I kind of thought, gee, a lot of my peers weren't doing that. So, you know, what is this about? And then I started realizing.
And did he ever talk about The Big Heat? Because that was Fritz Lang, and that was I can think about five or six films that were breakthroughs for him for different reasons. Right. That would have been one of them.
Yes, it was. And Fritz often came to the house. He was he has a not the best reputation, but as being difficult and, you know, and not friendly with actors, but he and my dad got along very, very well, and in fact they made Human Desire the next year, but Fritz was a guest in our home, and I met him, and he was a delight, quite frankly, and my dad loved making that film with Fritz.
And some of the other guests at your home, Aunt Rita Hayworth, Billy Wilder, James Stewart, James Mason, who served as your occasional babysitter.
Yes,
wow,
that's yeah.
Probably the greatest actor ever to be a babysitter. Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin, who had a very unfortunate impact on your beloved German Shepherd.
Yes.
That's quite extraordinary. And you were unaware of the significance of this at
the
time?
Well, until I was a little older. I mean, when you're four or five or six, you don't know. You're not aware of anything. But when I was older,
And when you went to the movies, you saw these people who were visiting your home.
Yes. They were family friends. And so it was at that time when you start coming aware of life in general, and certainly I was aware. Charlie Chaplin, did run over and kill my dog Bill, and it's a long, sad story for me, but that was a tragic incident in my young life.
So was there a little there were a whole bunch of different communities in Hollywood. There was the emigre community, and there what kind of community do you think your father had?
Well, Beverly Hills in that time was a little, small, close-knit community, and it was not like today. There's very few. Sidney Poitier lives around the corner from us, and Carl Reiner, who's not really an actor per se, but he lives close to us, but everyone else is either deceased or they've moved. So Kirk Douglas keeps home near us to this day. But in those days, it was a very, very close-knit community, and it was a very different world than it is today. But yes, all of those people, we all went to everybody's house. I went to Mary Pickford's up the street and sat on her knee when I was a kid. And I saw, through my mother, who was here on Broadway in New York City, I got to meet Eddie Cantor and Jack Benny, with whom my mom played. So it was just, I was blessed with a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to meet and know all of those people.
Had your father gotten into acting when he was still in Canada?
No. He came here in 1922 when he was seven. He was always a ham, to use the expression.
His name was Gwilym.
Gwilym. Yeah, Gwilym. He was Welsh, and that's William in Welsh.
And why didn't he change his name to William Ford?
That's a good question. They wanted to name him William Gower at one point, for Gower Gulch, where Columbia Pictures was in those days. But they went for – there was a place called Glenford back in Canada. He was born in Quebec, but the family live up in a place called Portneuf, up the St. Lawrence River. And so he changed it. He didn't, but Columbia Studios changed it to Glenford.
He's described as someone who played ordinary men in ordinary circumstances. But you quote him complaining, I know I'm no Errol Flynn. My nose isn't right. My mouth's not really centered. Am I really too homely to be in the movies?
Well, yes, that was the rap that he had a lot of when he first tried to make his breakthrough in the late 30s. He was deemed to not be attractive enough. He was not handsome enough to be a leading man, and he didn't fit the character role. So it took a lot of luck. He made his first film in 1939 for Fox as a test, a forgettable film called Heaven with a Barbed Wire Fence.
Terrible title.
Yeah, terrible title. And Fox didn't pick up his option, and he made a couple of $100 for that film over 6 weeks, and he was kind of despondent, but somehow, somebody at Columbia Pictures saw future, and he was signed, and he ended up doing 14 years of contract work at Columbia through 1954.
And over the course of his career, close to 100 movies.
Yes, yeah, 100 movies. And I'll just say this, Leonard, to me, and your radio fans out there can have their opinion, I don't think he ever gave a bad performance. He was in some turkeys, But he gave some, and he did some wonderful films. But I think as an actor, you can never catch him acting. He was a wonderful, wonderful actor, and I try and celebrate that in the book.
You say that he learned a bit about acting from appearing with Bette Davis.
Yes, right. They did a film early on, and you know he was always a student, and again. He never studied. He was not really one to go for the method or Stanislavski or any of that, you know, Stella Adler. He honed his skills as an actor doing little theater. And of course, New York is known for its theater, and that was exactly what trained him to be as good as he was. He was in seven different little theater companies in Santa Monica, California at one time, and he would do anything, you know, little parts, big parts, set dressings, and he went from one to the other, and that's how he honed his skills.
You have a couple of blurbs on the book. Debbie Reynolds says, Glenn Ford was more than an accomplished and brilliant actor. He was a master of his art. Comedy, westerns, drama, film noir, everything. I adored working with him. But the Scott Eyman, who you also quote on the cover, said, Glenn Ford never got the respect he deserved for being a tough, straight-ahead actor who always had a way of rising to the occasion demanded by Fritz Lang or Vincent Minnelli. His son's biography is a welcome tribute to a conflicted man and an overlooked star. Now, what did he mean by conflicted man?
Well, there's a dark side to the book, I must say. And without getting into the, you know, the grist of it, he was a great actor, and I celebrate that. This book is not a daddy dearest, and I think anyone who reads it will see that. But he gave of himself so much, Leonard, to his craft that he really didn't have time for his wife, my mother, or his son.
But he did seem to have enough time for other women. When you learned about just how much of a compulsive womanizer he was with so many of the people he performed with, that must have made you feel a little uncomfortable writing the biography of a man who – the bottom line is you love him. He was your father,
right? Yeah, it was difficult, and I must say it took me years to write it because I tried to thread that needle of being honest, and in some cases brutally honest about things, but yet trying to honor him. And you know, he came from a background. I personally, Leonard, I'm very tactile. I love hugging my wife, and I've been married 40 years to the same woman. We're just delightfully happy together. I think my dad it takes work to be married, and it takes work for a couple to give to each other. And my dad just didn't have that ability.
But the marriage to Eleanor Powell lasted quite a while. Did she just look past this?
No, well, actually, she did at one point. She just was. She just came to terms with it that he was not going to be faithful. He had a long term affair with Rita Hayworth, and she was in his life from when he was a teenager. He met her early on, and they made their first film together in 1940. And he was a pallbearer at her funeral. So the relationship with Rita is long lived. And Mom, basically, in California, the age of emancipation for a child is 14. And so my mother just made a decision that she was going to stick it out till I was 14, and then I could decide which parent I would be with. And I chose her, of course, because she was just an angel. And, you know, my dad and I didn't talk for a number of years, but then we reconciled about 1964, and we became pals. I never had the dad, you know, who took me fishing and did these fantasy father-son things that I think every son has with his dad. But we became buddies, and I was his buddy until the day he died.
He died 5 years ago. Was he still alive when you began writing the book?
Yes, he was. We worked together on it for about 2 years.
So your father was part of your research on your father.
Yes, yeah, right. Well, we would show his movies. You know, I'd show the movies. In those days, it was VHS tape, and I'd say, okay, Pop, what did you think? You know, and he said, that was a stinker, or I remember this and that. So it was a real opportunity for me to hear it from the man who was there and get the quotes directly from him.
Well, when I think of some of the breakthrough films, we have Gilda, we have The Black Boy Jungle, and you say you played a role in Rock Around the Clock becoming the theme music to that?
I did, yes, and that is covered in the book, but basically Richard Brooks, the director, came to our home, and I was a savant music guy. We were talking before we went on air about us both sharing the love of that doo-wop kind of music. And but anyway, I had Johnny Ace Records and Hank Ballard and the Midnighters and
But it wasn't Pledging My Love.
No, you're right.
Rock Around the Clock.
You do know your stuff, Leonard. I like it. No, it wasn't Johnny Ace. But Richard came to the house. He took three records to MGM, and he played them. And he decided Rock Around the Clock was the one for the film, and it went in. And MGM paid $5,000 for the rights to use it three times, and it's become the one of the biggest selling records of all time.
I'm sure Bill Haley didn't even mind selling it for $5,000 because he made so much after that. Your father was, you say, was perhaps happiest making Westerns.
Yes, he was.
Why do you think that is?
I think because they were the easiest. I mean, basically you ride up on a horse and, you know, dismount and have a couple of lines, and they were very easy. I mean, the dramas are the work, but he loved making his Westerns. And he was a fine, fine writer, and so he just loved it. It was like going on a vacation.
Some of them have become classics, and the Film Forum is showing a new print of 310 to Yuma for a week beginning tonight. That's a kind of a Western noir, so it mixes a number of the different genres that your father worked in.
It's a psychological, very tense psychological drama, and I think a very, very fine film. And one of the – I think that and Shane and High Noon at the time were kind of the triumvirate of really great Westerns at that late 50s.
Early Elmore Leonard.
Yes.
And did your father like it when you watched it again?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, he liked that one. And that's one of my not only favorite Westerns he made, but one of the favorite films he ever made.
Well, he played a villain there.
He did, yes. He would. They wanted him to play the Van Heflin part, but he said, no, I want to play the other part. And he did a great job, I think.
Well, hadn't John Barrymore told him early in his career never to turn down the part of the villain?
You're right.
Because that's always the best part.
You've done your homework. Yes, that is exactly what John told him. Yep.
So after the divorce from your mother, the only woman he doesn't seem to have married was Rita Hayworth, and he may have been the only man she didn't marry.
You're absolutely right.
How many women did he wind up marrying?
Three others. There was a total of four. He wanted to have a fifth one when he was 80, and I told him, Dad, no, you're done with this. I'm going to put a picture of Judy Garland on one end table, one of Rita on the other, and that's when Linda and I and my three children moved in with him to take care of him because I said, enough's enough. But the libido, Leonard, to the very last moment of his life was raging. So he was a man's man, that's for sure.
Well, were you ever tempted to go into the business?
I did a little, actually. Yeah, I did some. I was in a few early soap operas, and I've been in about 15 or 16 things.
But then you decided to become a contractor, which is nothing like acting, is it?
No, but I was never either talented enough or lucky enough to succeed acting, and we wanted to raise a family. And my dad, you know, basically was a... He had the first dime he ever made, and he said, "Son, if you want anything, you got to earn it yourself." For which I bless him. And I thought, well, what can I do? And I became a contractor and was very successful building custom homes in Los Angeles
and working on three Frank Gehry buildings.
Yes, Frank Gehry.
So okay, but we're pretty much finished with this conversation, even though there's a lot to talk about. But do you feel any differently about your father after having researched him and written the book?
No, I knew the story. I mean, I knew the story, and no, I don't feel any different. I just, you know, I think, you know, I'm very, very proud of his acting career. I never had the dad that a lot of sons fantasize about. You know, to the end, he never hugged me or told me he loved me. And I came to terms with that as a young man. And
you
I
should
thought,
have told him there was a role, a father.
Really?
Well, he
did
that.
Yes,
it better.
Yeah, Courtship of Betty's father. I said, gee, I wish that could have been me, but it wasn't. But you know, I was never bitter, and I don't think the book is bitter either, Leonard. I hope it doesn't come off that way, and I don't think it does. So I tried to be respectful, but I tried to tell a story, and it is a very interesting story insofar that a lot of people have no idea who Glenn Ford really is.
And Peter Ford's biography of his father, Glenn Ford, Glenn Ford, A Life, published by University of Wisconsin Press. Peter will be introducing the 7:30 screening of 310 to Yuma tonight at the Film Forum, and then it will be shown for a week. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.
I want to write on the 310 to Yuma. That's where I saw my love, the girl with the golden hair.